I want to just tell you a little bit about my background. My children, my oldest is 29. She was born in 1974 in southern New Mexico. And I became a leader, a Leech League leader, in 1975 in southern New Mexico and was the CLA of New Mexico for several years in the late 70s before we bought Mothering in 1980. So Leech League is my home, where I feel like I got my foundation as a parent and still continue to draw inspiration. And so I'm grateful to League and to all of you for being here. Can everyone hear and see, and will you holler if you can't hear and come up closer if you need to? There's that huge pole in the middle. Hello over there. So I'm going to try to move around, but if you can't see me or you need to move up, please do. I call this talk Teens as Scapegoats and Prophets of Society because I think that says it all, really. And I wore this outfit today as a demonstration of that. This is my costume. Because about, 10 years ago, I started seeing these young girls wear these big fluffy skirts to proms and stuff, but they'd have tennis shoes and this sort of dressing down, these formals, right? And I think, what are they wearing now, you know? And look at me. I'm wearing this skirt now. I got to buy this outfit, and I thought, this is the very outfit that 5 or 6 or 10 years ago, I thought, what are they doing? And now I'm wearing it. The things that my kids say, my son has always said for the last few years, he said, it's all good, Mom. Everyone says that now. You know, the music that they listen to, the phrases that they use, we put them down for it, and then we imitate them in 5 or 10 years. So it's a very difficult time, the teen years, and I think for those of us in La Leche League, we think, well, I'm in La Leche League. I've done everything right. These things aren't going to happen to me. But it's sort of the opposite. It's like the teen years are something that has to happen to teens, and our good parenting definitely will serve us well during that time. But there's still an inevitable process that the teen goes through of differentiating from us during those years. That means that at some point, they have to look very critically at our life. And at first they just go, it's like they woke up one day and they went, what do you eat that weird stuff for? Why are we vegetarians? I'm not like that at all. So for the first time as teens, they begin to take a critical eye at our lifestyle, and they just accepted it before. And I'm here to tell you that they embrace it again later on. I have a dear friend that I went to high school with, and when our kids were about, they must have been about 15, we didn't see each other all the time, but we happened to get together and we looked at each other and we said, I don't think it gets any worse than this. I think it gets better, we said, we hoped. And in fact, it did. So it seemed like there were those early teen years in which what I came to call the dark phase, you know, in which my daughter she ran into the house one day, my oldest ran up the stairs and dyed her beautiful long blonde hair totally black. But she had so much hair that she didn't even get it all dyed. She kind of got it half dyed, and some of it was on the rug, and then she had to go buy more to get it all black, and she looked so terrible. And I came to call that the dark phase, where it's, don't look at me, don't see me, I am invisible. So there's such a self-consciousness in those years and such a lack or sort of development of self-esteem that we sometimes misinterpret their behavior and take it personally. So that's why I called the talk We Grow Up Ourselves, because the biggest challenge in the teen years is not to take their behavior personally and to stay grown up yourself, you know, and not be, oh my goodness. Remember the day my youngest locked herself in the bedroom, and the others had all, you know, unlocked the door after a certain amount of banging, but she was not going to let me in that room. And I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't control her behavior. So that's another thing you learn as a parent of a teen, that your whole relationship and your whole job with them changes. So let's talk a little bit about what actually is going on in the teen years. And I do want to leave a lot of time for questions, because I think that's essential at this age. I'm sure you have lots of particular issues you'd like to just kind of get some opinions on, so I do want to leave a lot of time for that. But if you know Eric Erickson's work, he talks about the different stages of life, and I particularly like him because he talks about the early years, that in the first year of life, it's the crisis of trust and mistrust, that the child's supposed to be learning to trust the environment by the way that we interact with them. And what happens then in the teen years is that they begin to establish a stable self-identity. So, and at risk there, in the first year of life, it's the trust or mistrust. In the teen years, it's stable self-identity versus role confusion. And, you know, of course, the big question, who am I, right? Who am I? Because they've been somebody else all along, that somebody somewhat defined by their family and society. And they're making the transition as if it's a bridge from childhood to adulthood. And I like to think of us as the bumper rails on that bridge, that they bump up against us, checking in, making sure, am I going too far? More than ever, they need our participation and our boundaries. And a lot of times I think when children become teenagers, you see that their parents kind of give up on them. You wonder, where did they go? Or they get tall, and so you think they're grown up. And in fact, they still need our support and our help as much as ever. So they're going through a, they're really working on establishing their self-identity and are differentiating themselves from us in the adolescent years. They're also starting to think differently, and the fact that they're awkward in their thinking is because it's kind of new thinking for them. You know how they get so argumentative in the teen years, so righteous and so often right. It's as though we've taught them by the time they're teens, by our logical communication with them, to be much more logical and much better at debate than we are. So they're like our best students. And then in the teen years, we're like, oh my goodness, what can I even say to you? You know, I finally decided that humor was about the only thing I had left in the teen years because they didn't want to hear my preaching. And I read this article, it was in Mothering Magazine, Diana Cor- No, it was Diana Cordy wrote this article on mothering a long time ago, and she said, just talk to them. Just talk in the kitchen, in the car. Just keep talking. You don't know if they're listening, but they're hearing your point of view, and that's what you want. So desperately to tell them during those years when you know you feel that they're somewhat at risk by their behavior and by their attitudes. So they're learning propositional thinking. They're learning to weigh this and that, to consider different possibilities. They're also very idealistic. They see things in a very wonderful way. You know, they see things as they should be, and they haven't quite figured out how to reconcile the inconsistencies and the incongruities in society and the things that we do that are different than what we say we do. They're also, as we said, very argumentative and very self-conscious. It's almost to the point, I think they just begin to be self-conscious. I can remember even being, when I was 12, and remembering when it was like where I first began conscious, I just somehow first became conscious of myself in a new way. And you feel almost naked, like everyone's looking at you, and teenagers are like that. They feel like they're the center of the universe, that everyone's criticizing them and looking at them, because that's what they're doing to themselves. They're weighing and measuring themselves against society's ideas, against their peers. And it is the time of life that they are supposed to identify with their peers. Joseph Chilton Pierce talks about seven, sort of these phases of 7 years. And then in the first 7 years, the child bonds with the mother. In the next 7 years, with nature. And then from 14 to 21, with peers. And then from and at 21, with God. So in that those years from 14 to 21, they are trying on the values and attitudes of their peers. And that frightens us sometimes. Because up until that point, we've been pretty much compatible with them and pretty much in control of their behavior. But when they start to experiment and try on new ways of eating, new ways of dressing, we don't know what to do and we don't know what's important. We don't know what is important to make a big deal about and what we can let go. Teens are also very self-centered, again, because they're so sure that everyone's looking at them and because they're thinking so much of themselves. They're very self-centered. And they're also very indecisive because now they've learned how to think in a new way in which they're considering all possibilities and they don't really know what they think yet. I mean, they feel passionate about things, but something they liked yesterday they may reject today because, again, they're just looking at things for the first time with the new eyes and with their own eyes. So the teen thinking, just like teen bodies, is awkward. And I think it's a kind of a higher thinking that takes getting used to. And there is a whole hormonal thing, as you know, going on with the teen years. There's been some research that has shown that teens really shouldn't get up so early, that their brains aren't really functioning that early. And, well, we know that. And mine doesn't function that early either, so I'm real sympathetic to that. But, you know, it's hard during the teen years to help teens understand routines and things that are necessary but that aren't compatible with their way of being. And again, because they're so idealistic, why do I have to do that? Why do I have to go to school? Why do I have to conform? And you know, what really challenges us to be really honest. You know, I remember reading an article in a newspaper about a man who, he was so mad that his son wouldn't wear a tie to this wedding. And he was telling the son how he should wear the tie and how this was what you were supposed to do. And he was very offended that he wouldn't do it. And I thought, if he had just said to his son, this is really important to me, I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable at this social gathering if you wear this tie, would you do that? I think he would have done that for him. But when he tried to make up a reason that the son knew was illegitimate, then he wasn't going to go along with it. So there's a kind of a radical honesty that teens require of us that is really very hard to come up to. Because when we tell them the truth, because they are, I think, the most honest among us. I find the teens the most real and the honest among us. They're vulnerable and they see things really clearly. And I think we really need to appreciate that, even if we can't, even if they can't always, even if things aren't always perfect for them, you know, so that when they aren't, I think telling them the truth. I always thought if I can just tell my truth, my kids the truth about the way things are, then I won't burden them as much with my ideas that may or may not change, but can give them maybe some real ideas about how things are. The other thing about the teen years is that the rules have changed. We go from being managers of our children's behavior to consultants in the teen years, and that's hard for both of us. A book that I really recommend is called Uncommon Advice for Parents of Teenagers, and it's by Michael Riera, R-I-E-R-A. And he's written a couple of other books. His are pretty much the best stuff I've seen on teens. He's a high school teacher. The Uncommon Advice for Parents of Teenagers, Michael Riera. He also wrote a book called Surviving High School. And I'll mention these again at the end. But he talks a lot about this shift from becoming managers of our children's behavior to their consultants. It takes adolescents a while to figure things out for themselves, and they certainly need our advice, and we have to keep telling them about our values because they really want to comply with those. But we have to do it in a different way, and it takes us a while to find that way, and sometimes the kind of fits and starts and the fights that we have during adolescent years really can undermine our confidence and make us feel like, gee, what is going on? I thought I had a good relationship with my child. What is up? Most parents don't know how to react to this change, and they either do one of two things. They either overparent, treating the child or the adolescent more like a child and getting more active. This is the parent who grounds their child so much that there's nothing left to ground them for. You know what? You're done with it already. How much more? That fails to be effective after a while when it's overused. Or underparenting, where the parents treat teens like adults and relinquish involvement with them to avoid conflict. I see this a lot. I found as my children got into the teen years that I always previously had known all the parents of their friends, and if anyone would spend the night, we'd be on the phone, or where are they, who's coming over, we'd be scheduling things together, and then a certain amount of the parents kind of disappeared when the teen years happened, and I'd say to my kids, do they have a mother? Do these people have a mother? Doesn't she call them up and find out where they are after a couple days in the weekend? So that you see that there's a certain intimidation. The child gets tall. And I remember when my son got taller, it was like he was a buck sort of in the, you know, okay, I'm tall now, you know, I must have power over you. I'm taller than you, Mom. And, you know, it's like, I don't care. Okay, bring it on, you know. But I think for a lot of parents that's intimidating, and then they think, well, maybe they know more again than they do, and it's hard to reconcile that sort of awkward thinking with these growing bodies that look so adult and have so many adult capabilities. So it's important to focus not on them necessarily making right decisions, but on them making their own decisions. And Mark Twain has a great quote that says, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. Right? And, you know, you hate to see them go through these things. You hate to see them. You know, the first time your child falls in love and you know it's the wrong person and you know their heart's going to be broken, you can hardly bear it. You think that somehow by virtue or because of your virtue, your children will be spared some of the difficulties that you experience, don't you? You think you can spare them from life's things and life's heartaches. And, you know, you learn that what you give them is tools. You give them tools to think about things and to communicate, hopefully, but they still have to suffer, as all of us do, and have heartache, because that's just part of life, and we don't not have that, as we all know, because we're good people. So is good parenting, because so we ask, so on one hand the rules have changed, the kids are different, teens are different, they need a different kind of relationship from us, but have things really changed? So is good parenting a guarantee for an easier adolescence? I think it's not a guarantee, but I think it makes a huge amount of difference. And I think what makes the difference is that underlying everything, we still trust our children. And one of the things we learn in La Leche Liga is to trust ourselves as mothers, that our instincts are legitimate, that they're valid, that we can base our lives on those and that instinctual knowledge that we have as mothers. So we learn to trust our children. And in the teen years, we sometimes think, oh, we can't trust them anymore. Who has this child become? I have to do more. And I remember I was going to a counselor during the time that my kids... And I certainly recommend it. Now, at the time that my kids entered their teen years, and I went into this one session, and I thought, okay, I'm going to ask her what to do. And I said, okay, so what should I do with my teens? You know, what's the answer, the secret? And she said, just trust them. And I thought, oh, no. I wanted more. I wanted a paragraph. I wanted a book. But that's really what it boils down to, that they are really the same person, and that the minute you forget that you love them, or that they love you, you're on the wrong track. The minute you think that they don't love you anymore, or that their behavior means that they don't care, you know, it's not right. It's just not true. They're hurting. Usually, just like in the young years, when bad behavior means that they need something, that they have some unfulfilled need, it's the same thing in the teen years, that when they're acting out, there's a little bit of risk that's reasonable, but when it's too much risk, then they're needing some boundary. They're needing some definition from us. So our children are still basically gentle, compassionate, and caring people. And we can still trust them if we've raised them in an atmosphere of trusting their own experiences, which we've learned from La Leche League. It's important to recognize also that during the teen years, the children have to take risks. That's how they differentiate. That's how they learn. In fact, healthy risks stretch them. They give them safe boundaries. There's another book called The Romance of Risk by Lynn, I don't know how to, it's Ponton, P-O-N-T-O-N. And she talks about how it's by taking risks that they learn to be independent. Now the question is, what are healthy risks and what are unhealthy risks? It's important to know that taking risks is essential, because that's another thing that freaks us out as parents of teens. We're like, well, why are they doing this? And, you know, what are they thinking? So team sports are a good thing to direct your kids into. There's a great way to take risks. Individual sports. My son has been a snowboarder and a rock climber and a kayaker, and you know, he'll call me from Colorado and he'll say, Mom, you know, Crested Butte is the steepest slope in North America. I'm like, I'm not happy about that, Finny. That does not excite me, darling. So I go out and buy him avalanche things and these little, you know, I do the best I can. Okay, if you're going to go there, then you're going to have to take these avalanche detectors. And so he's always been a risk taker, and that's how he's, but yet he's done it again in really healthy boundaries. I think not for me, it's not what I would choose to do. I'm much more chicken than that. But for him, he's really found his risk in sports, and not necessarily team sports, but the individual sports. My kids always love to camp, you know, outdoor activities, camping with friends. There's a way to get independence and make some mistakes within, again, a kind of a controlled setting. We have a little barn on our property, and my kids used to always have slumber parties over there, and I could yell out of the house, you know, be quiet or turn down the music. And so I felt like they were close, but not too close. Now, as they're now in their 20s, I've heard some of the actual things that happened in that barn. And I thought it was right next door. It was okay. But it was fine. You know, it was, again, having camping, things like that are ways that they can do things that take risks but have some controls on them. Drama and art, creative pursuits are good risk-taking activities. Travel, I think going on group trips, going on car trips, buses, going to Europe for, you know, a semester if that's possible. And doing work and volunteer and internships, anything that, you know, gets them out into society, again, to experiment with themselves and see how they do in new settings. So I think with risk is not so much to feel that they shouldn't be taking risks, but how do we differentiate between what's harmless rebellion and harmless risks and things that are really danger signs? Because isn't that always what you're worrying about in the teen years? It's like, okay, is this okay? What is going too far? You know, what should I worry about? So I always try to differentiate between their hair and what they wore and what they ate, because those seem to be things that just concerned them. They didn't really, I mean, I might not have liked them, but they really didn't hurt anybody but them. Like my daughter dyeing her hair, you know, I hated it, but it was just embarrassing. And that's another part about, you know, growing up. I mean, my friends would say, I saw your children smoking on the plaza. My children? They aren't smoking. You know, I sat my daughter down. I was like a schizophrenic. I said, oh, honey, I can help you with this, darling. I can help you with this. And I'd stand up and I'd go, oh, not my daughter, you're not smoking, what are you doing? You know, and then I would be, I can help you with this. So there was this disbelief that your child, my child, is looking like this, doing these things. And that's that pride part. That's that pride. Our children are almost like, they become like this commodity to us, this social collateral in a way. You know, if they're doing the right things, then we look good. It is so hard when they look bad to society and to others. So hard for us to deal with those things. And that's where we really try to control their behavior, because other people think it's such a reflection on us and that it is our fault, as though we could control them. Now, I do highly recommend tying them up and locking them in their rooms, because what other, I mean, I remember when my kids became teenagers and I thought, I really can't control their behavior. They're out there on the plaza in public. They're not all here around me anymore. I can't control everything they're doing. I do have to trust them. But that was so hard to do that, and so hard to bear my own opinion of them as they went through that phase. And still in their 20s, I feel like I can talk a little bit more about the teen years now, but now I have children in their 20s. One went to college, the rest haven't. They aren't following the, you know, the Ivy League prescription that a lot of people will, you know, brag about their kids and say to me, oh, yes, you know, my child's in Yale and they've got 2 degrees and they're getting, I'm like, I go to dinner with my son. And I say, honey, what are your goals? He says, well, I'm going to get a job, mom, and a car. And I'm like, honey, I have some other goals for you. So bearing that trusting, loving them, it's the biggest act of love that you do. And when they get older and then they start to kind of do things that, again, you can't control, you have to trust that they find their way back to, even if they go off their path for a while, the true deep self that you know and love, you know who they are. So I think that dress and hair and food are pretty much harmless rebellions most of the time. The piercing and tattoos is an interesting one. When I first used to give this talk at La Leche League, no one would admit that their children had pierces and tattoos. Well, they weren't even tattoos. It was more like a few pierces. I remember going to an Arizona conference, and this woman was so apologetic about her daughter and all the piercings she had. And then she came to dinner with us, and she was the sweetest, most darling girl. And she had a couple of piercings in her ear, and it was really no big deal. But her mom was so embarrassed. And now I find that the moms have the piercing and the tattoos, you know, right? Like, I'm thinking, I'm not. I've never even pierced my ears. I can't even get through that. But it has a whole different appeal and a whole different look now. So I think that's a little bit of a challenging one. My youngest daughter really liked the piercings, and she did her belly. Oh, because her father said she couldn't. I couldn't believe it. Her father said you can't do your nose. So instead she did her belly button, which, you know, because it didn't show. But I was more worried about her belly button. That didn't work. She reacted to the metal, but now she's still got her belly button. She's 21, who's 21, and that's working now. But then she had a tongue pierced for a while, which really I hated. You know, I live in a town where there's an acupuncturist on every corner, and like this huge, like, tongue is just very important to the body. So I really tried to because I couldn't, you know, once they were 18, they could get themselves pierced and tattooed without my permission. So I tried to focus on the health aspects and to say things like, well, I hope you choose a tattoo that you'll like in 30 years. And that's been fairly successful. And to try to talk about the health benefits of the tattoos, I mean, of the piercing. And I thought that was an article that we never have gotten that I'd like to have, because there are some actual health considerations with the piercing. There are, you want to find somebody that really is really good at it and uses good metals and has a good follow-up antiseptic kind of procedure. But it's very popular now, and kids really, you know, they really like it. So I don't think it's anything that we're going to be able to avoid. And who said today that they were going to go into the business of tattoo removing so they could be a great business in the future. But again, like so many things, that changes, and I think that's kind of harmless too, although there's a line between what they call body art and body mutilation, I think. There's a little bit of a line there, so I think that's something you can talk to your kids about. Again, I think kids, as we're talking about the way that they think, they really respond to information. Sometimes they don't always let you know that. You know, they don't go, hey, that was great, but you'll hear later about it, or you'll hear through somebody else. When my kids were smoking cigarettes, I would sit them down. I sat three of them down once. You never want to do three against one like that. You really want to have some support or get the, you never want to go into that kind of situation. I sat down with the dirty lung, you know, the picture of the lung. They still laugh about that to this day, but they, you know, I thought it was, you try to inform and talk about your values at the same time that you understand that they're going to be challenging them. Caffeine, tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, a bunch of things that, you know, depending on your family values, you're going to have different responses to. And, you know, our own personal examples in our homes are really the best thing. The way that you live your life is the best thing that your children are going to model after. But even when you live your life in a certain way, children are going to be influenced by their peers. And I did find that my kids picked up, we didn't smoke cigarettes, but they picked that up and then had to deal with the addiction. You know, that tobacco is more addictive than heroin. It's more addictive than any substance. So I had a poster on my refrigerator for a long time of ways to quit smoking, which actually helped them. So, again, sometimes not, you know, talking, you need to talk and then put up things for them to look at, information. So I think we have all those things, and then we have the things that are absolutely, we all agree on, hard drugs, fast cars, unprotected, exploitive sex. Those are the things we really want to protect our kids from. And that's why in those teen years, we want to make sure that we're saving our strong response for the things that are really life, you know, that really make a difference, life and death. And I don't mean to put down those other things, but there is a difference. And I think one of the disservices we do to our teens is when we say to them, yes or no, we don't give them any differentiation. We need to give them more information about drugs than just yes or no. We need to say there's a difference between heroin and marijuana. There's a difference between speed and ecstasy. These are what I know about these drugs. These are the health benefits, the health problems. These are the social problems with them. We need to, because otherwise they go into a party and they, if you just say to them no, see, and I was raised this way, I have to say, so I felt like because I was raised with just prohibition, I didn't have the tools I needed when I actually went into a social situation to tell the difference between things that were just kind of okay, maybe if I had a little puff of marijuana, that's not going to kill me, as opposed to something else. And I wasn't a big experiment, I don't mean that, but I think you really got to give kids honest information about the differences. Give them books to read. There are some good books that actually, you know, there's a book called that Consumer Union put out called Licit and Illicit Drugs, and it has chapters on alcohol, on caffeine, on heroin, on every drug, and it has all the research that's been done on it. It's a very objective, in a way, thing to give to a teen. There's also a book called Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, that is, you know, and as a researcher in, you know, a journalist, I'm used to looking to research, to get evidence, to try to investigate things. So I wanted my kids to have that information as well. But there is a difference, and I think we want to differentiate for our kids between use and abuse, between the use of something and the abuse of something. And it's interesting to know that 50% of adults 18 to 35 have tried marijuana. 90% of people in the United States have experimented with legal and illegal drugs. And one out of every six people smoke marijuana. So I'm only say that because I think we have this, again, this... that we make all these drugs the same, and I think that kids are... Well, the research shows that kids who experiment a little bit have better judgment as adults because they've taken a little bit of risk in adolescence. The kids who do nothing are a little bit too uptight to make good decisions as adults. So a little bit of experimentation is normal. A lot... Something that becomes a problem is not normal. It seems like my kids did a little bit of stuff... A lot of stuff, not like lots of stuff, but a little bit, like climbing out of windows once. You know, one time I went to pick up my son, his friend had shoplifted something from this drugstore. I had to go pick him up from the detention home, his friend, and get him out of there before 5:30. And I remember getting them in the car and I said, this is the only time I'm coming here. You know, this, I'm not coming here again. So it seemed like they did stuff, and then if I came in with a really strong boundary and said, no, this is just not, that they respected that, you know. Not respected it, because in a way, their behavior's out of control in those years, and they're influenced by their peers, so it's not like they're consciously saying, I'm going to go get in trouble. They just have that bad judgment we were talking about before. So they say that the number one protection against substance abuse is a strong mutual attachment between parent and child. So again, it's relationship. Relationship that really controls our behavior with each other. It's our love of each other that keeps us from going too far. Or somebody saying, hey, I care about you, clean. You know, come on, you're going too far here. I remember my son once was out with a friend and they kind of swerved around in the car on some ice and I said, you cannot drive with him again. His mother called me up. Oh, but they're best friends. How can you do this? I'm like, you are not driving in the car with him again. So those things, again, where it was life, where it was driving, where it was fast driving, where it was unsafe behavior, I was like, you know, this is it. There's no... And yet I also chose not to punish or ground my kids. I never punished or grounded them. In fact, sometimes they would ground themselves. They would come home and say, I'm grounding myself. You know, I'm out of control. So I always tried to use my relationship with them, my love with them, to control their behavior, because I just believed that that was what controls behavior. It's because we cooperate with each other. We learn cooperation because of our love with each other. So one study, as I said, showed that the better adjustment in adolescence for kids who had done a little bit of experimentation, those who had abused or not done any... And again, it's not to say it's beneficial. I'm not saying let's go all out and experiment. I'm just saying that you don't have to totally feel like, you know, it's the end of the world if there's a little bit of stuff going on. I think that's kind of what they test in adolescence. You know, they test against those limits. But again, that we have to be uncompromising about issues of safety, legality, and morality. You know, sex is another one, another issue that comes up, and this is... We hear so much about how much teenagers are having sex, you know. It's like they're having sex at 6 or 8 or 10. I mean, by the time, the statistics are awful. Well, when I actually asked my kids, or they actually mentioned this later, because it didn't seem to me that my children were doing that. They didn't seem to be having sex especially early or anything and having those experiences or be feeling that they should have those experiences. And later I talked to my daughter in her 20s and she said, you know, whenever people would ask us, we'd always say yes. They thought they were supposed to be having sex. So if people like did these surveys and said, so are you having sex? They'd say, yes, certainly I'm having sex. So I'm not sure that these statistics about how many, you know, is about how many kids are having sex is true in adolescence. And I think it's not, you know, it's certainly geographical and certainly some areas more than others and some whatever cultures, subcultures you live in, time with. Okay. I thought it was very important to continually talk about, again, my values with my teens about those things, to anticipate, not wait for them to bring up the subject, but try to just anticipate it and bring it up, even maybe say, oh, you know, what about, somebody was talking to me about their daughter, or I was wondering about that, or have you had to, what are you thinking about that, or to try to really... have open conversations, but I think that some teenagers want to talk to their children about those intimate things and some don't. I found that my children were much more likely to talk to their siblings than they were to me, the older ones. And often when I have, like I said, four children, and often when I have a concern about one of my children, I'll say, you know, to my other children, will you please talk to them, you know, about this? And they have that same concern as well, and that's worked very well. I think that, again, if you feel that you're uncomfortable talking about things, also asking a friend or asking them to, you know, you might ask a friend to talk to them or ask them to talk to a friend. Sometimes that's a little bit safer, another adult friend that they might have, an aunt or a close friend of your family. Another piece of bad news we always hear about teens is how violent they are. You know, they're just so violent, and that's another myth again. They're, over the last 20 to 30 years, there have been hundreds of scientific studies that have indicated that aggression is not essentially innate, and that violent behavior is in fact influenced by a variety of biological, social, situational, and environmental factors. There was a statement on violence in 1986. It was called the Seville Statement on Violence. And 20 top international scientists said that it is scientifically incorrect to say that we have an inherited tendency to make war or act violently. That behavior is not genetically programmed into human nature. Quarter of? Oh, thanks, sweetie. So if, you know, sometimes, and that's what happens in the teen years, again, you start to project to your child that they are violent, or like when my son would play with war toys, you know, he had these little, they had so many G.I. Joes, my two youngest kids, oh my God, and they're jumping and doing all these games with them. And I said to my son one day, and this is, he wasn't a teenager, he was younger, I said something about being concerned about these war toys, and he looked at me like I was from Mars, like, I'm not into war, Mom, you know, what are you thinking? So it's sometimes we see behavior, maybe again some angst, teenage angst, maybe a little bit of what appears to be violent behavior, and then we're afraid, oh my goodness, they're turning violent. But again, it's the environment that changes that. So what is the optimal environment for letting children ripen into compassion and to caring individuals, so that again we counter the violence that we're often afraid of in society and with the violent programming on television? What the studies show in terms of people who are nonviolent, who are caring individuals, is that their parents are able to regulate their emotions. Again, the example that we set, because it's all about modeling. Human behavior is all about what we see. And what's often most difficult about our teens is that they do exactly what we do, and we don't like it. Because we don't like what we do, you know, is it? So, you know, they often are doing exactly what they've seen, and then and we have to... have to grow up. Parents model caring behavior. Parents set appropriate limits on their children's behavior. Parents communicate that the child is responsible for his or her behavior. And parents use reasoning to help direct the child's attention to emotional states and to the consequences of their behavior on others. Sure. Parents use reasoning to help direct the child's attention to their own emotional states and to the consequences of their behavior on others. So again, by modeling our own caring behavior, our own regulating emotions, the way that we speak to them and communicate to them, it creates that kind of behavior in them. And I'm happy to tell you that that continues into the 20s. The things that I sort of noticed that I felt were like sort of off with or the things I wanted to improve in my relationship with my children in coming into their 20s, I found that by changing my behavior that, in fact, they changed their behavior as well, that I would see them model, like, I guess what I'm saying is, as I learn new ways of relating, they would pick up on those new ways as well, so that I feel like that always goes on. It just goes on and on. So what do teens need from us? They need us to keep a good opinion of them and to believe in them and not to be afraid of them. And we can do that by increasing the number and minutes of our total interaction with them. And in those interactions, to reduce the amount of times that we talk and increase the amount of times that they talk. Because most of our interactions are them talking at them and them going, yeah. And I can remember sitting in the car with my daughter. I'd come on with this huge tirade. It would just be so perfect. I had said everything just perfectly. And my daughter would look at me and say, I have no idea what you said, Mom. You know, I had reasoned it out so well that it was much too complicated for her. So increase the number and minutes of the total interactions that you have together. And increase supportive communication and decrease defensive communication. And increase positive interruptions, asking for clarifications. What did you say? You know, I didn't understand that. Tell me more. And decrease negative interruptions, which is not listening, looking away. You know, so in other words, it really is all about letting your teen know that you understand them. And I think we feel the most understood when we're simply listened to. So, you know, trying to train ourselves when we want so much to tell them what to do and what we think, to ask them questions and to listen to their answers will give us a lot more information about their behavior that we might not realize. So let's talk a little bit before we go to questions about warning signs. How do we know if our teens are in trouble? You know, I talk about let's all be open, let's accept them, let's appreciate the fact that they're going to take some risks and continue to trust them. But how do we know if they are in trouble? Dangerous risk-taking, like continuing to take dangerous risks. I always said to my kids, if you're ever in a situation where you have to get in a car with somebody who's been drinking or using drugs, don't do it. Call me. I will come anytime. No questions asked. No questions asked. I'll pick you up. And I think them knowing that, and I'm sure I got that from somebody else in league, but, you know, knowing that, I think, gave them a way out of those situations that they might not have imagined themselves beforehand. And I would always say to them, you know, if they were late or they didn't come home when they were supposed to, rather than being angry at them, I would say, you know, I was so worried about you. And I said, you have to understand that if you're not home, I'm calling the police, I'm calling the hospital. I'm worried to death about you. And my one son at 11 got lost in the woods with five girls, and it was really scary, and they were lost all night. We found them about 5 o'clock in the morning, but when they were found, and we were talking about what happened, they had all been sitting around figuring out, you know, just thinking about what we were thinking, and we live in Santa Fe, so it's very new agey, and one of the girls said, oh, my mom is channeling us. And my son said, my mom's calling the police. So I think that's, again, one of those boundaries, one of those safety things that it was like, I want them to know the truth. I don't want to make them feel bad because they, you know, like they were late, and it was usually, I mean, half the time they're late at some stupid thing that they did anyway, that they, like, they all fell asleep somewhere, and, you know, there would always be a lot more innocent than it seemed. But so dangerous risk-taking, ongoing debilitating emotional distress beyond the teen mood swings. This is all the time in the bedroom with the door shut, withdrawal or alienation, can't get on top of things. You know, a real kind of a depression. Frequent crying or violent outbursts. Frequent, how do you define frequent? Yes, I don't know. Again, I think things have become chronic as opposed to acute. You know, with illness, we say, okay, if something's happening, you know, acutely, that's okay. But then when it becomes chronic, it becomes another thing. So if any of these things become chronic. Lack of friends. I always would notice, okay, do my kids have friends? You know, are people calling? If their performance in school drops or their attendance drops, there's probably something going on. Not checking in or abiding by curfew. It was always essential to me. Again, with anyone you love, you need to know where they are. Call me up. Where are you going? Where are you now? We always are checking in with each other. That's commonplace. Now they're like me. Why didn't you call me when you got to that hotel, Mom? I didn't know you got there safe. They are like mad at me if I don't call them now. They're, you know, and fast driving, mixing drugs and driving and alcohol, hard drugs, exploitive, unprotective sex. Again, all those things where, again, it's this, they're inherently out of control, but when they're, And you get it in your gut. You know it's not up here. It's like you just can't stop thinking about it. You're worried about this. Something worried about him. And I remember going out with and talking to one of my son's dad and his wife and saying, I'm really worried about Finney. We all need to really be watching him now. I think he's getting out of control. And by kind of shoring up and watching him, then he got, kind of calmed down again. But they have to know, it's like the bumper rails. They're going to go out there until they know, is somebody there? How far can I go? What is this new world? I feel so powerful. I can do anything. But they need to know, no, you don't do this. You are not doing this. You stay here. And not because it's wrong. It's because I'm worried about you, because things happen, and things happen to teens in cars. So how do you love teens? You got to have a lot of faith. Pray for them. Remember the love. Be a good example. Don't be surprised when they don't do what you do or what you say. Talk to them. Be your authentic self. I think that's your best thing with teens. Get as real as you can. Talk from your heart. Use sense of humor and hang out with them. The other thing I always decided when they were teens is that nobody feeds them. Nobody feeds them. After they get to be teens, where are they? I don't know. But I thought, okay, if I always feed them, they'll come to my house. So I got a ping pong table. I was always cooking, and I always loved to cook, so that was no problem. And I was always feeding 10 or 11 kids, So you just put a pot of soup on the stove and a ping pong table or something for them to do, and there is no way they won't hang out at your house. So make your home a safe haven where they have, because they really have nowhere else to go. Where do they go? And there's an old quote by Dorothy Parker. She's a humorist from the 30s, and she said, make your home a safe haven, but when all else fails, let the air out of the tires. Oh, I'm sorry, there's no air, and I don't know where. I don't have a car. So I'd love to have your questions, though, because this all sounds good, but, what are you struggling with? Yes, ma'am, you got to come up to that mic. Come on, we'll yell then. How many times? Oh, they never called. They never called. But I asked them about that recently, and I said, did that help you? And they said that it did, but they didn't call. Did yours? But see, I don't know that they call. See, the point is not so much that they call, but that they don't get in the car, right? I don't want them getting in the car. So I want them to know that that's not cool, and maybe they'll figure out something. But I think if they were really in trouble where they couldn't get out of there, that they would have called.
My mother did that, and I called her once.
You did call her once? Good for you.
She said her mother did that, and she called her once. Right on. Good. Wait. Yeah, somebody's back there. Go ahead.
Just a couple point comments, I guess, really, more than anything else. I work in a high school. I think there's a couple of us in here that work in high schools. The high school I work in is larger than the town I grew up in.
Yeah,
I'm serious. 3,000 students.
Wow, that's so hard.
Okay. And I think one of the things that I witness, I'm a permanent substitute. I'm an oxymoron. I float all over the school. I probably know the school better than some of the teachers because I'm all over the school. One of the things that I notice, because I'm there all the time and I do hear the students, is it's really important for parents not to deny what might be happening with their children. Because I will hear it in the teacher workrooms, the teacher who will call the parent. And mind you, this can be another teacher whose child is misbehaving and really having a problem. Oh, not my child. Don't play denial games. The other one is just a humorous comment, because my children are now in their 20s. Is I'm talking with my daughter on the phone, and we had a miserable time separating in late teens. We had some violent, wordy arguments. And she said, we were joking about the fact that I says, oh, you mean I'm not a perfect parent? And she said, well, Mom. And I said, oh, let me get this straight. You prefer my set of imperfections to everybody else. And she said, yeah, you got that right.
That's very good. Thank you. I think it's normal, though, for us to at first say, oh, not my kids, when it's sort of first happening. I mean, I remember my kids did something up in the hills, and somebody called me, this neighbor, and they were making all this noise up there, and I thought it wasn't them, and the police came, and I even defended them, and I said to them, just tell me the truth. So when I talk to this policeman, I can at least know what the truth is. Well, they didn't tell me the truth, and later they were, in fact, being kind of, more rowdy than I thought. So I think your first impulse is, no, it it's not my kids, but then maybe to stay with it and to really find out what the truth is, because you do want to respond, you know, correctly. And do you want to come up, or are you yeah, oh, sorry. I think, because this is being taped, so it'd be just better if we can get it on tape.
In our Leleche meeting, in the evening meeting in Eugene, Oregon, where we have lots of piercing and tattooing.
Excellent.
We have recently had a woman who really had a lot of breast infection and problem because of nipple piercing. And so I think it's really good to differentiate between harmless and non-harmless.
Oh, I do too, and I think exactly those are the things now we're beginning to know.
And especially in a La Leche setting, this is something that we might put the word out in our communities, even by just calling the piercing parlors and saying, here's something that's showing up in the La Leche meeting.
That's a very good point. Now, do you know if it was, like, do we have any information about one, is it one piercing, multiple piercings? Is it any piercing in the nipple that is going to be potentially dangerous?
I'm not an expert on that. I'm sure there are people who have more information than I do, but this is a topic worth pursuing perhaps in the magazine
very
and definitely
good.
Pursuing by, you know, local La Leche people, breastfeeding activists, just to communicate with the piercing people and, you know, say, hey, let's differentiate. Let's talk about this with regards to, you know, teenagers can't foresee themselves breastfeeding for 6, 7, 8, 10 years of their lives. 6, 7, 8, 10 years later from when they have the piercing.
Very good point. Thank you. I will look into that for an article. I would like to make those distinctions, because I think we don't know those, and then it seems like we're just resisting it. You know? Did you have a question or? Oh.
Just a comment of what we've told our children about piercings and tattooing, that because we pay all of their medical bills, they cannot have, besides pierced ears, tattoos and piercings, because we can't afford to take care of the potential problems that could come up. So that's one thing you might try.
Go ahead.
I have an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old, and about 5 or 6 years ago, when my son was 12-ish, he has to go to a party, and he hadn't done the cat litter, hadn't done the dishes. It was his week, blah, blah. And my first answer was, no, you haven't done your chores. And I went off to do a letter, and I thought to myself, you know, if I hadn't done my chores and a friend invited me to a party, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd go. So I went to him, and I said, you know, Thomas, this is not fair of me. You can go to this party because I said to him, if I were invited to a party and I had undone laundry or what have you, I'd go to the party. I said, but I would still know that those were my responsibilities. So I think you're old enough that you need to start making your own decisions and fulfilling your own responsibilities. Well, when do I have to have it done by? He said. I said, I just said that was your job. But you know that being part of the family means that you have these responsibilities to the whole family unit. And do you know, he's 18 now, and maybe once in the past 5-ish, 6-ish years, I've had to say, come on, you know, you're going here and there, and all this is piling up. I can't do it all. I need help. And just kicked right back in. And I did it in such a way, I was so shocked at myself. You know? So, and it works, and my daughter is the same. I learned with my son, so she gets that benefit, and I started younger with her, and it's just a good thing. So, you know, it's nice when it kicks in.
Well, it's nice the way you said it, that you need help, because then that engages his cooperation, and he wants to help you, as opposed to you're bad, and you didn't, and then that you kind of recoil from that and resist that.
And it was like, we think that our kids have to pay for the privilege to do these social things that should be part of their lives. And really what we need them to learn is that we have to guide them into how to do everything to fit things in on an even keel. So,
and
just
how
keep praying
and how
working.
A family works, you know, and how that,
exactly.
that how those responsibilities. And I find still in the 20s that I still have to kind of go, wait a minute, look at, if they haven't had their own household, they don't quite get it yet, you know. But once they do, they help a lot more after that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello. Yeah, please.
I was curious. You had mentioned with clothing and hair and what have you, those kind of temporary things that those things, it's kind of okay to let them go a little bit further. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you know what I mean. But I would be, I'm worried, what do you think about the clothing and what have you by association dealing with maybe their clothing looks like gang members' clothing or hate group? Or, I mean, I know sometimes they just like that style, but where can we draw the line so that their clothes don't get them killed or their hairstyle doesn't get them killed?
Well, I think I tried to call, I was calling those harmless rebellions. When they're not harmless, when their implications are harmful, then I think we do have to step in. So I think we look at it. It's like, I can't make it black and white exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not that simple, but I think there are some things where, okay, they just did their hair and there's no ramifications for anyone but them.
I see.
And you think they look bad, but, you know, it's like just, but, and if they're, and I also think, another issue is all these branding clothes, the clothing with the logos, and how there's a whole politics there that they don't even know they're being victimized in some ways or used. So I think that we need to point that out to them. And I remember even pointing out Nike shoes to my daughter when she was younger, and she was like, oh, but I have to wear these. Everyone wears these. But then it sunk in after a while, and then she chose not to. So there's also that. That, you know, when they're littler, they're going to do it right away. You have to sometimes have a give them a period of coming to understand your point of view and kind of educating them about it. And I think, again, don't be afraid to say no, and those things that you do feel, again, are those safety issues, and to trust that. I mean, I would rather err on the side of saying no for something I thought was safety than of let them, you know, do something that I think could harm them. So where I advocate this openness, I think there's also this vigilance, because you always, you're like, no, you know, you can't let you. Because what happened with my daughter with her hair when she dyed it, as I eventually said to her, honey, you look cheap. You can't dye your hair anymore. You know, you're going to, people look, because they see the way you look, people are making a bad opinion of you. And I can't let you do something that I know is hurting you like that. So, and she didn't like it, but then later she was happy that she got her hair, blonde hair back. Plus the other thing is you trust that you're going to do some things. And I remember Carol Burnett saying this. Her daughter ended up in a rehab center, and she said, I wish I had said no more. Because you try to be friends with them, and you know, you want to be happy with them, and sometimes you have to bear them being very mad at you because you do the right thing to protect them. And they don't know it, but later they're going to know it. So there is a fierceness that you have to have about protecting them in those years. Thank you. Hello.
I have one of those houses that all the teens come to, and I found that the secret is frozen pizzas, brownie mixes, and lots of fresh fruits and juice.
So they can grab out of the refrigerator real fast, right on.
Cook.
There you go.
That's
good, though.
That's
and they like right. those things, too, that aren't
they
too hard to fix.
That aren't too hard to fix. But I would just like for you to comment that one of the things that I see, and I would say on any average night, we probably have somewhere between 6 and 12 teens at the house, and that's the amount of incredible amount of non-sexual touching that's going on. I find that they're always tangled up. They're all laying all over the beds. They're on the floor with all the pillows and the blankets. Now, we do have a one blanket per person rule at our house, but other than that, could you comment on the and we do hand checks but could you comment on their need for non-sexual touching and how we can facilitate that? Because that's really been a surprise to me. How much touching? I mean, they like to draw on each other and give back massages, and the boys are always doing push-ups with the girls on their backs and that kind of thing.
And it's not just league, right? I mean, it's just like, I see that too. They're like puppies, right? They're like little puppies just jumping around and touching. So,
how can we facilitate that?
I mean, do we have to? Aren't they pretty good at it? I mean, I think they should facilitate it for us. How do we learn how to do that? We forgot that, right? I mean, I don't know. I think they're just exactly what you described was great. The entanglement and the, how can we facilitate it? Hmm.
I think it's cultural.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. Talk about that. She said it's, she thinks it's cultural.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Mexico, and in Mexico, we're hugging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and to tell you the truth, I have problems here when I go and say, like, if I find a husband of my friend and I go,
want to come up to the mic, sweetie? Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to come in the mic.
Oh, boy.
I'm sure. So you started to say you were from Mexico,
I'm
and
from
many
Mexico,
other cultures are more touched.
Latin cultures,
yeah,
from Latin origin, they are very touchy. We are very we are always hugging. From we are babies, we don't see it bad. And I think here or other cultures, they just see it really nasty, you know, like bad. And like I was saying, if in Mexico I find the husband of my friend and I go and say hello and hug and a kiss, it's not that sin. If I do it here, oh my God. You know, first he has to let me do it. You know, or if he's a Latin male, you know, and the wife is American, maybe their kids are going to see it bad because this is a different culture. So I think is like they were saying, it depends how you see the things. If you're seeing bad that the kids are just, you know, like she was saying, doing push-ups with the girls.
Oh, and so, so in a way,
then you're going to start like, you know, but if...
No, and in a way, they're practice touching too, aren't they? They're practice touching themselves. They're finding out how it is. So maybe the answer is to encourage it in some way, to say things like, oh, just somehow say things that are positive reinforcements of that, rather than, because we know soon enough they're going to get other kinds of messages about that. And maybe themselves they'll get them also as they get more sexually active, then that all gets defined a little bit differently as well. So, I don't know if I know the answer to how to facilitate it, but I love it too. And I want to, you know, I just, and I always, because I had my two olders were 18 months apart, a girl and a boy. So we often had boys and girls over and all these combos that were not sexual. I mean, I could look with my eyes. I could tell, you know. And I think that we think, oh my goodness, they can't be having slumber parties, all these people. But then they were all my kids, you know, and it was fine. They worked it out and I also like the idea if they're going to be sexual, when they become sexual and in a safe environment anyway. I don't want to feel that they have to go and hide that and make that dirty. So just...
I've got another facilitation question. I have a 12-year-old who's kind of shy. And as you mentioned, going through that high self-conscious, everybody's looking at me, I don't want to take a risk because I don't want anybody to laugh at me or do the wrong thing. Any suggestions on how to help those kids develop new friendships and reach out to kids who they don't know?
How does the new friendships fit into what the problem is? Because is your child not making new friends? Is it self-consciousness?
She's got some friends. She would like to have more friends and more closer friends.
Can you identify talents that she has that she might not see, that you might reinforce, and then through those talents she might find other friends that share that? Because a lot of times when you have a talent yourself, you don't think it's anything special. You know, my daughter was in choir all the time in high school and now has turned into a singer, but she never thought then that I'd say, honey, don't you want to take singing lessons? She'd be like, you know. So would that help to help, again, give her some objective reflection of something about herself that she might not know? And
we're
that might lead her.
We're doing some of that. And I think the other thing that's just really hitting home, too, is I grew up in one of those houses where we were all always at our house.
Yeah.
And we're going to Marla's chaos workshop so we can help make our house more like one of those houses.
More chaos, good.
Yeah. The kids are always at our house, but I want to make it more and more friendly.
Any environments that you can go to. I mean, I don't know if this is an environment where would she come and meet some kids, or is there's sometimes some pretty cool camps for kids, like right in your community. I don't know. I would try to identify places where you think there's going to be some kids that you think will have similar values, and then try to see if you can get yourself in those environments.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, Carol.
I'm happy to be here again. I've come to
Thank
many of
you.
Your teens talks because my oldest one is 36 and my youngest one is just coming out at 18.
Wow.
But I wanted to talk about my two younger boys. I had a boy who was in junior high and high school, not doing well, very, very angry. And there came a point where he was going to be dropping out of school if I liked it or not. And I had to go to the school, and I was sobbing. They were giving me tissues because I could never envision this happening in our family. And even I'm thinking about my dead father rolling over in his grave because it was so painful. But he dropped out, and he went into a GED program. He did very well. He became independent. He got a job. He's been working very steadily at his job, and I think it was the right thing to do for that boy, as painful as it was. We were going through something similar with the youngest boy, and I was talking to the counselor, and I said, you know, this looks like he's going to be leaving school also. I'll have to go down to the administration and disenroll him. And he says, you don't have to do that. I can do it over the phone. This tells me that the process of kids dropping out of school has become very easy and very acceptable in our society. And I think it's something that we have to worry about. We did everything we could to try to find interventions for our boys, and it didn't work. And, you know, fortunately for them, you know, they're doing better now. But what's happening with our schools that it's so easy to let kids drop out?
Well, I appreciate your pain, and it was very similar to my own. My youngest as well dropped out of high school, and she had gone to a preparatory school, which I wanted her to stay in. She hated that. She wanted to go to the regular high school, and then she had a difficult experience there, and also didn't work for her, and she dropped out, got her GED, and now has, just in the last few years, taught herself to play the guitar. She's writing songs. My oldest daughter called a couple nights ago and said that Nora had done an open mic at this place in town. So I think that the children sometimes with these creative minds or artistic talents find the school environment just not tolerable. And so I'm not sure. So in the way schools have failed them, so what's the problem? Is the problem the schools, which should be more accommodating different kinds of learners? And is it, again, the kids maybe being smart enough to know that that isn't the good environment for them? I mean, I felt like you. I felt like such a failure and still feel so confused about this. But I think now that my daughter was really smart and really knew what she needed and is certainly not lacking in intelligence. So if we can find, some communities have more educational options than others, educational alternatives, certainly homeschooling is an option, and I thought Nora would do that at one point and did it a little bit. But again, is it, you know, I think the schools are not giving, you know, not supporting a broad enough range of students, and I think there are other alternatives out there for them. And I just know of so many people who maybe it didn't work for them in high school and they ended up still being successful. I think it does too, and it's so hard when they don't do that. So Carol said it comes back to that same trust, and again, when they, and I think it's so ironic because my kids, I homeschooled them. We had a school called Sandhill Day School, and the motto was every experience carries its lesson. And then, like, I'm surprised that they aren't going to college, you know, because they've learned to learn through experience, and they have, in fact, done that. And today, in today's society, a college education doesn't guarantee anything. You know, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to make X amount of money or that you can definitely predict that for sure. So it is, I think, again, they see things the way they really are, and I think that oftentimes they are right, and we do have to trust them.
Well, I have a question. It's, you haven't addressed computer games and
yeah.
the teens and the,
well, evil
and,
games,
and
yeah.
television. We have limits on that, but just really we're looking for other insight. I mean, we have a limit of screen time, and that includes, you know, television and computer, but the games are just very, very violent. And we're really trying to limit that and finding positive, good computer games on, you know, and I don't know if I haven't seen that addressed in the magazine yet, at television, of course, but just if there's other insight into nonviolent things that teens like.
In terms of video games. Or
anything on the computer, you know, CD-ROM games, and we don't have Nintendo or anything like that, but just the computer games, the CDs, I mean, they're teens, they're mature, you know, for.
Yeah.
Mature. I mean, they're.
I think
really
it's a huge
violent.
Problem, and I kind of missed it with my kids. It wasn't quite as popular, but we did a piece on violent video games, and I was just distraught to find out that every single bill that had been passed in every state, all across the United States, to limit the access of children to violent video games had been fought and destroyed by the video game industry. So it's really not that, I mean, we should get rid of these violent video games. They shouldn't be accessible to kids. But I'm not sure if I have an answer on what else would work for kids interested in those things.
Input on that, too.
Yeah. Maybe, I think somebody, did you have an answer to that? You should go up to that.
A study just came out in the last several weeks, I believe, where they, and I mean, I don't know who sponsored the study, could be the video game makers, but that those video games actually, I can't remember what they helped, but it was something like eye-hand coordination or something, and they really haven't, they don't seem to increase violence. And my son plays a lot of video games, and people are always surprised. I mean, I know a lot of other people who don't parent the way I do, who, when I tell them I leave three boys home all day by themselves, they say, don't your kids fight? My kids have never laid a hand on each other. And my 18-year-old son has been playing those games for a long time. And I think it's really important to listen to what your kids say. And he says, Mom, I know the difference between a thing, you know, like a screen and a real person. And when he was looking into colleges, he was, I hate to sound political, but one of his things was, well, this one's pretty close to Canada, so if they have a draft, at least I can get out of here. You know, this is not a kid who's going to war, so I just wanted to, you know, listen to your kids and talk to them. They know. I don't think a video game is going to turn them into a violent person.
No, I think unless there's something else going on. But there have been some disturbing studies about that and some kind of brain changes that happen in the brain from watching all that stuff. But it usually happens, there's usually some sort of predisposition there. So I guess we're saying the same two things. Let's limit those things and let's also trust their experience. Again, as I was saying in the whole teen thing, watching their overall behavior, is that contributing? But boy, I still think that limiting those things is really important because you don't always know the effect it's having on you. Think it's nothing. Thing, but it really does affect the brain waves. I mean, too much looking at all those computers does that, and all kinds of screens. Go ahead.
I have a question about the evolution of the relationship between the mom and the son. I see so many, let's say, 11, 12-year-olds that are very affectionate. They'll run up to mom, hug, group hug, that type of thing. They hit 13, and the next thing you know, they interpret mom patting them on the back is something that's inappropriate. Suddenly, as soon as they're interested heavily in girls, and I'm not even talking dating, they're simply looking at them. They suddenly, the relationship, that touching relationship they had with mom, suddenly becomes unacceptable to them. And is that common? And do they, how does it evolve later on when they get older, 18, 20, do they get to a point where they once again find it acceptable for mom to give them a hug or a kiss? And this isn't a cultural or a family that can be very touchy-feely.
How old is your son?
13.
He's so perfect. Exactly. I was going to guess that. Because at 13, you are supposed to be invisible. Right? And I don't even know if it's the touching as much as that you are just, like if you take them anywhere when they're 13, like to a prom or something, and you're driving, you must not speak. You must not really be there. They're not going to interact with you. They don't want to talk to you. They're like totally silent. It just drives me mad. So I think it's really, again, them finding their independent way, and they're not, you know, and I think you can find other ways to touch them, try back rubs, foot rubs, try to experiment with things that would be acceptable to them, but they definitely do find their way back to that. And don't give up on that, and don't give up on touching them, and tease them and say, you know, yeah, tease them.
Yeah, I've told them that I need to.
Yeah, I need to touch you. You stop it. Get over here.
Is there an age frame where they come back, like at
18, 20? I don't know, but at 24, I have to say, the other day I said to my 21-year-old, because she was sick, and I said, here, let me hold you like a baby. And she's like, no, Mom. And my son said, I want to hold me like, you can hold me like a baby, Mom. And he's 24, so I think they do come back.
Just a comment. I've got one that's turning 14 today, actually. And I've found with the touching that a lot of it has to be home in private. If no one sees, he'll let me touch. Or if I'm in bed watching TV or whatever, he'll come up and cuddle. But God forbid we do it where anybody else other than family can see it. So maybe it's one of those things you need to catch him alone. That might help.
That's a very good point because, again, it's all that image thing and being independent
in front
of the friends.
When something else is going on, put a movie on and sit on the couch with him.
Put on what now?
put a movie on and sit on the couch with him. That's what my husband does.
Yeah, coziness.
With my 14-year-old daughter, he's not, you know, somehow, somewhere, she won't touch me as much anymore either. Because she, I don't know.
Because they don't know what the touch has a new definition.
And
they don't know what it is.
He wants to respect that, but he wants to be able to contact her somehow, so they watch movies.
That's good.
And then she'll touch, sit by him.
So it's part, you're in that transition of trying to figure out the new thing, and but don't give up. Don't, like, change. Just keep trying to figure it out. Thank you. What? Tag your it. You like that? That sounds like you run around the house, chase each other, yeah? Oh, all right. That sounds cool.
Yeah, I don't know if this is going to be some experience people have shared, but I'm wondering about my older daughter's 14, and she seems to have like these extremes of behavior, like going on the computer for everybody else I've asked has said yeah, it's normal, but you know, for like 3 days, all she does is
like obsessed into something for a while,
and instant message somebody, and then she comes out like she's blinking in the light. Especially since it's summer, I guess she's been able to, you know, kind of sink into, and then she'll read for 3 days, and then we'll see her again.
So, are you concerned more that she's withdrawn? What is the?
Yeah, maybe.
But she's not withdrawn, really. I mean, she's just absorbed in something, right?
Oh, I think so. But I'm wondering if I'm trying to distinguish between.
I think it's withdrawal if she doesn't have any friends, and she doesn't ever come out of that. I think if she comes out of that, it's okay. I think that's absorption. That's a great way also to free her mind, and like she can then escape into that. She comes back into life, so that seems fine to me.
Okay,
but I think if she didn't have friends or if she never came out of it, that wouldn't be good.
She doesn't come out of it to want to be involved with us anymore.
No, she doesn't like you, right? No, forget it. You're not cool at all. You'll get cool again, though, but, you know, and you got to get, and you know what I used to say to my kids? Sunday dinner, that's it. I don't care. You're coming for Sunday dinner. So we always, every week, had one time we had dinner together, because otherwise they're gone forever, and they don't care, and you think, why don't you care? And but, you know, to really protect some of those family rituals.
Hi. I just first wanted to thank you, because I, too, have seen you speak several times, and thank you. My daughter, she's my oldest. She just turned 13, so I'm new to this. And the intensity of the passion. Yeah, and it is wonderful, except that it's a lot of work. We're now vegetarians. For a while, we tried other things. And it's just, I find that she's so intense. She got a book and told me all the things I can't buy because, you know, the company does this, that, or the other. And I finally said to her, you know what? I can do it this far, but I can't do it that far. And I'm just wondering, I want to encourage her passion, but I have to rein it in because
Try to keep, like, think if she's a friend. Think she's your really good friend who came over and said, oh, I'm so excited about all this. I'm doing all this stuff. Well, she gets to do this stuff, right? But she doesn't get to tell you how to do it. Okay. So you can, you know, you have limits in your home about how much you have to change, but you don't, but if you could somehow still facilitate her doing her thing, if she wants to be a vegetarian, you'll help. You'll get all the stuff that she needs. You need to say to her something like, I need a little bit more time with this. I can't change quite as quickly as you, so I want to help you and support you, but I'm going to need a little bit more time. You don't need to, do, like, let her then become the parent. I mean, you still have the authority, and that's important, is you keep your authority as a parent, even though sometimes you're not exactly sure if you're right, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, you still are in charge. You want to keep that. So you don't want to give her the impression that she's in charge, because that's what drives teens crazy, is all of a sudden we let them be in charge, and then they know. They don't know what they're doing. They know they're out of control, and they really feel out of control. So you can set the appropriate limits that you just described with her without that being a problem for her or mean to her.
I think the hardest part is I finally get it, and then she's on to something else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go. That sounds totally normal.
Okay. It's not just me.
They're cutting through all this. They're creating the new reality, right? They're the future. They're the future, so they've got to figure it out. Sir?
Grateful for what you said.
Thank you very much.
Grandfather of a teenager.
Oh, good.
And I'm a pediatrician. My name is Dr. Raj Anand from India.
Oh, wonderful.
One thing which I have found helpful is an extended relationship between grandparents and the teenager.
Oh, very good.
My wife finds this very helpful, and they have a fixed schedule of talking to each other on a Sunday. He lives in another city. I find it very helpful. Secondly, as a pediatrician, I find that when parents bring the child to me with some problem, need not be emotional problem, it may be medical problem, but if there is a communication developed between the pediatrician and this teenager, who knows that he has another friend here, when he cannot talk to mom or dad, here is someone with whom he can communicate, talk, share joys and sorrows. I thought that also is quite helpful.
Those are wonderful suggestions, because again, it's almost you're extending the extended family then, you know, to the grandparents, which is wonderful, and then to other caring adults, and the more of those there are, and then as a pediatrician, you have a certain knowledge and expertise that can help both the parent and the child tell the difference again between not a problem and a real problem. So thank you. Let's take one more question. It must be about 4:38. Okay. All right. One more question. Hi.
I teach a human sexuality course to seventh graders.
Ooh, what can you tell us?
a 27-week course, which is mind-boggling. I can tell you more words for parts of the body than I ever heard before, especially male parts. And I also give a talk on human sexuality at some of the Lelechi Lake conferences, and one of the books that is tremendously helpful that a lot of parents have enjoyed is called From Diapers to Dating.
Oh, good.
By Deborah Hefner. And it's very similar to Lelechi Lake philosophy in the sense of that it's communication. And it respects people's values of their family so that you keep your own values and gives some very concrete ideas on how to deal with that, because I know it's a difficult situation. I know teaching this course, I have parents come up and they would like bow at my feet and kiss my feet that I'm talking about sexual issues with their kids because they really don't want to. So I know it's a difficult topic for a lot of people.
Can you comment on the question about the touching thing, about encouraging the touching?
Well, in this course, because it's 27 weeks, and it's not just sex education, that's called skin hunger. And it's a very important thing. I mean, we certainly see it with our babies and the way we are with our babies. It goes on in adolescence, and it's a very safe sexual practice. So it's not a bad thing, and we need it being human beings.
I wonder if we could even get the massages now and then, huh? How about something like that? Maybe get a massage. Yeah. You know, they see, encourage again them to think of that as normal. Oh, no.
No.
And they don't want to touch those other people that they're horseybacking with yet. They're just like, because I'm thinking about that. Well, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, sure, it's From Diapers to Dating. And it's Deborah Hefner. She was president of SEICUS, S-E-I-C-U-S. And
that's a good organization.
Right.
Yeah,
she's not president now, but that's sex education. I can't remember what it stands for.
Yeah, me neither. Never.
They have a wonderful website. Pardon? Hefner, H-E-F-F.
That'll be Hugh's wife.
Two Fs. H-E-F-F-N-E-R.
Thank you all so much. Good luck with you, and good luck with your teens, and thanks for being here. Appreciate it.